research company SWG has revealed over half of Italian citizens oppose the government's plans to raise defense spending to 2% of GDP by 2028. Doing so would align the country with NATO's desired threshold.
I think that increasing our spending on weapons now is insane. We are already strangled by high inflation, high cost of living. I'm against the government's plan.
Italy counts very little at an international level. I am afraid it would be much more useful to remain inside the current international context and go with the flow.
Italy's next aid and military package to Ukraine is to be announced by the Meloni government in the early days of February. Max Civili, Rome.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has announced a series of punitive steps against Palestinians in response to Friday's shooting in East Al-Quds. The operation, which was carried out by 21-year-old Khair Alqam from East Al-Quds, killed seven Israeli settlers and wounded several others. The steps announced late on Saturday during a meeting of the Israeli cabinet included new moves to expand Jewish settlements. The cabinet, however, has not provided details on how settlements would be expanded. Other measures include granting gun permits to Israelis, a move seen as a green light to Israeli civilians' use of guns against Palestinians.
These are parts of more collective punishment, more aggression and crimes against Palestinians. They are speaking about home demolitions and stripping citizenship of the families of those who carry out such operations from the real owners of the land, and more such moves against the people of Al-Quds.
The cabinet also decided more punishments for the families of those who carry out shooting operations by deciding to demolish their homes. Early on Sunday, Israeli troops raided Attur neighborhood where martyr Khair Alqam came from and sealed up the entrances of his family home in preparation for its demolition. The Israeli cabinet voted to revoke residency and citizenship rights of families of those who carry out shooting operations from Al-Quds and lands occupied in 1948.
The decisions of the Israeli cabinet are only about using much more violence, fierce violence against Palestinian people, and about consolidating the system of racial discrimination and occupation. Their decisions will not change much and will not break the Palestinian resistance. And in my opinion, this government is failing and will continue to fail because fascism cannot prevail. And nobody can break the will of the Palestinian people to struggle to be free.
Friday's operation came only one day after Israeli forces shot dead nine Palestinians during a raid on a refugee camp in the northern West Bank city of Jenin. That brings to more than 30 the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces since the start of this year. Observers argue that the Israelis themselves should be now worried about the repercussions of the right-wing regime's policies, including the deadly raid on Jenin. They add that the Palestinians won't fear Netanyahu's further restrictions and collective punishment they already are used to under Tel Aviv's occupation. Mona Kandil for Press TV, Occupied Ramallah.
Hundreds of angered Muslim protesters converged on the Swedish embassy in London to condemn the recent desecration of Islam's holy book. Protesters came from across the UK in order to make their upset clear and to pressure European governments to take anti-Muslim hate more seriously.
This is the latest example of a protest to take place as anger across the Muslim world remains incredibly high. This week alone, there have been numerous Quran burning protests and promises by right-wing activists to continue the pressure. As the protests continue, the anger will continue to grow too.
Activists informed Press TV how their love for the Quran compelled them to act.
We live for Quran. The Quran is very respectful. The Holy Quran is not our word, not our book. It's the book from Allah, then has to be very respectful.
This should stop because this is our human right, as well as the European laws, as we are living in European continent, the European law states that every religion and their religious leadership must be respected.
On Monday, a Dutch politician tore apart a copy of the Holy Quran in the city of The Hague. It followed an incident in Sweden where a politician burned a copy of the Quran outside the Turkish embassy. These extremists have been receiving authorities' permission to conduct the heinous acts, even provided police protection under the guise of freedom of expression. Mosques, Muslim-strong residential areas, and embassies belonging to Muslim countries have all been the target of these Islamophobic incidents. This blatant state facilitation of anti-Islam extremism has led many Muslims to feel vulnerable in a continent which claims to defend minority and religious rights. Robert Carter, London.
Geomatics is not a well-known term amongst the public, but it's actually the driving force behind many of the daily activities in man's modern life. The second Iran Geo Exhibition offers a quick glance into the rapidly growing sector and Iran's latest products in the field.
Geo means earth, and geomatics is a science and technology that deal with the collection, distribution, and analysis of geographic data using aerial and satellite imaging. To put it simply, when you take an online cab, you're using a geomatic technology known as GPS, which is short for Global Positioning System.
Geomatics has its traces in almost all economic sectors, from mining to oil and gas. It's used for air navigation services, archaeological excavation, climate change and environmental monitoring, disaster risk reduction, and estimation of crop yields. Over the past decade, an increasing number of tech firms in Iran have expressed interest in geomatics.
We develop aerial imaging and surveying technologies. We also offer geophysical services. Here in this expo, we're showcasing our imaging and surveying drones, which can draw maps and collect topographical data to facilitate mining operations.
As the organizer of the tech event, the Iranian Defense Ministry says it is planning to encourage more companies to operate in geomatics to turn the strategic field into a viable source of income for the country.
The world is shifting toward new and strategic technologies. Our country, too, is treading on the same path. Geomatics and its associated technologies have numerous applications. They are a major factor in advancing our space program. So, we invited major brands to this expo to help us achieve our goals by advancing geomatics in our country.
Organizers say during the 4 days of the second geomatics exhibition, B2B meetings will be organized between investors and manufacturers. The event will also hold workshops for startups to acquaint them with the needs of the market.
Without geomatics, many businesses such as online ride-sharing services would not exist. Experts here say the range of applications of this discipline is growing even wider, and this will attract larger investment to this field in the near future. They say this global trend is already happening in Iran. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Yemenis are urging their government to take decisive action to end the Saudi-led blockade on Yemen before the month of Ramadan begins. Due to Saudi Arabia's strangling blockade, food, fuel, and gas prices increased drastically during the holy month. Here at the Al Sanaa market, where many Yemenis do their shopping, customers said they want their government to adopt measures that will resuscitate Yemen's economy and end the continuous price hikes.
The strangling blockade is why food prices are increasing. When prices increase, it makes life harder for business owners.
We ask our government to improve our ballistic missile capability because it is our missile capability that will break the siege.
According to Mohammed Miftah, who is an advisor to the president of Yemen's Salvation Government, the cabinet's main task is to keep Yemen's battered economy afloat in the midst of a brutal war.
The government's main task, given the current circumstances, is to provide essential services like electricity, water, and building roads so people can travel. It's true, prices remain high. However, in the near future, the government aims to provide services at a lower price. In general, the main cause of the surge in prices is the Saudi blockade.
Mohammed Miftah says, despite the surge in prices, the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen's economy is leading to nowhere.
The enemy was hoping to strangle Yemen's economy completely by preventing all fuel and gas from entering Yemen. We have successfully foiled this plan, and now fuel and gas are available, even though they're slightly overpriced. The important thing is that they're available, which is more important.
For the time being, the Yemeni government shows a willingness to engage in peaceful political dialogue to end the war. However, much of the public has lost hope in the peace process. Yemeni people are calling on the Salvation Government to break Saudi Arabia's siege on the country before the holy month of Ramadan. Sana'a has called on Riyadh to lift the blockade multiple times. The kingdom has so far refused the requests, which means Yemen's next option could be a military one. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
The memory of the rape and murder of pedestrian Sarah Everard in 2020 by then Metropolitan Police Officer Wayne Cousins is seared on everybody's mind here. The police commissioner at the time, Cressida Dick, called it a case of a few bad apples in the force and promised action to weed them out. She was soon forced to resign, leaving a police force in crisis. The latest scandal to rock the Met, David Carrick, an officer from the same unit as Wayne Cousins, pleading guilty to tens of offenses, including rape against 12 women over nearly two decades. The response from the new commissioner, Mark Rowley, an apology and the promise of a cleanup. Yet critics of the Metropolitan Police Force say they don't think that will solve the problem.
I think the proposition that it's just a few bad apples has been blown completely out the water. What we have in reality is a deeply systemized culture of misogyny and racism that speaks and exists at the very heart, the core of the Metropolitan Police Service. It is beyond reform. It is beyond saving.
The force commissioner Rowley commands was placed under special measures last year after revelations of bullying, racial discrimination, and misogyny among some of its officers against people inside and outside the force. New anonymous revelations from serving police officers speak of a culture of racism and sexual abuse in the force, which has left some black staff suicidal.
The issue is that systematized culture actually targets and alienates black and ethnic minority officers. And that has a profound impact upon their family life, their mental health, their physical health. And we've seen examples, haven't we, time and time again, of black officers suffering life-changing, transforming trauma as a consequence of facing racism in the Met.
These are dark days for Britain's largest police force, with confidence in policing already at an all-time low. And the recent admission by one of its own will worsen trust in the people who are supposed to be protecting society. Cyper is up, London.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The natives of Canada and the US have a painful past. This truth was revealed when the mass graves of hundreds of Indigenous children who died while attending boarding schools were discovered in Canada in the summer of 2021. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Tehran Times wrote in this regard, for decades, a large number of Indigenous children in Canada who were taken from their families and forced into boarding schools never returned home. An investigative team has found 66 more potential unmarked graves at a former residential school in British Columbia, the Williams Lake First Nation, WLFN, said recently at a press conference. It brings the number to 159 found at the former St. Joseph's Mission Residential School. 93 were uncovered in May 2021. Run by the Catholic Oblates Order, thousands of Indigenous children were forced to attend the mission operated between 1886 and 1981. More than 150,000 First Nations, Métis, and Inuit children were forced to attend the 139 Indian residential schools. The first one opened around 1825 and the last closed in 1990s. The schools were funded by the Canadian government and run by the various religious denominations. Their mission was to wipe out Indigenous traditions and assimilate the children into the white culture. More than 4,100 children are thought to have died in the schools, sometimes buried in mass graves, and at other times in graves that, if they were marked, became obscured over the years. More than 1,900 unmarked graves have been uncovered to date. Last year, the findings of mass graves of Indigenous children in Canada also caused an uproar in the world, and it seems that the story is still going on. Some experts and observers believe that the findings of mass graves of Indigenous children indicate dark and shameful chapter in the history of Canada, during which the Canadian government separated Indigenous children from their families to send them to the boarding schools affiliated with Catholic churches or for adoption to white families in line with the prohibition of using their mother tongue. Numerous reports of physical, emotional, and sexual abuse of these children have been released, and the available documents show that the students of these schools were exposed to the spread of mycelis, tuberculosis, influenza, and other infectious diseases, and many lost their lives. But it is clear that these chronically and intentionally underfunded institutions actually cause the high death rates among students. What is also indisputable, based on the government's own records, is that generations of federal government officials and politicians knew that the subpar conditions in the schools were killing children and chose to do nothing. According to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, TRC, the Indian residential school system was an attempt at cultural genocide, but the escalating number of recovered unmarked graves points to something even darker. The internal conditions of the schools were unpleasant. Their buildings were poorly heated and unsanitary, and children were exposed to emotional, physical, and sexual danger. According to experts, at least 3,200 Indigenous children died while attending school, although the number is said to be likely much higher. An estimated 6,000 children die at the schools, according to the former chair of Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Murray Sinclair. Many Indigenous peoples blame the residential boarding schools that have played a major role in the lives of generations in Canada for social problems such as alcoholism, domestic violence, and high suicide rates. Canadian politician Selina R. Kaysar, in her July 2021 interview with Mehr News Agency, said there is no doubt that residential schools were designed to eliminate Indigenous culture, not just for land, but also for the belief that their culture was inferior to that of the European settlers on the land. It is the entire foundation on which colonialism is built. The removal of Native people from their land, source of energy and livelihood, for the perpetuation of the idea of white supremacy. The release of the horrifying story of the discovery of hundreds of mass graves in the grounds of old residential schools from which the bodies of Canadian Indigenous children were removed caused tension in this country claiming human rights and a dispute between the Canadian government and the Vatican. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has urged Pope Francis to visit Canada to apologize to Indigenous people for the Catholic Church's treatment of Aboriginal children in schools it ran there. In a visit to Canada, Pope Francis apologized to Canada's Indigenous communities for the Church's harmful legacy over residential schools. I ask forgiveness in particular for the ways in which many members of the Church and of religious communities cooperated, not least through their indifference in projects of cultural destruction and forced assimilation promoted by the governments of that time, which culminated in the system of residential schools, he said. In general, the recent discovery of unmarked graves at boarding schools in Canada is like a nightmare for many Indigenous Americans and Canadians that has never been forgotten. In the meantime, Tasnim News Agency reported the Iranian Foreign Ministry described the discovery of another mass grave of Indigenous children in Canada as a great human tragedy and a blatant example of the genocide in a country whose government resorts to hypocritical and deceptive shows to pretend support for human rights. In a statement released recently, Foreign Ministry spokesperson Nasser Kanani described as a major human tragedy and genocide the discovery of more mass graves of innocent Aboriginal children in Canada has revealed in fresh reports. He said the refusal to present clear reports on the unearthing of these mass graves indicates the true extent of this human catastrophe and is a reminiscent of crimes committed during the UK-controlled white people's tyrannical and racist rule in Canada. These major and heinous crimes have been committed in a country whose government has, by putting on deceptive and hypocritical shows, always tried to create the impression that it is an advocate of human rights and express its opinion as an interventionist country about developments in other countries as if they were beholden to it, he explained. The Foreign Ministry's website reported. The spokesman said, the Canadian government's slogans and claims are aimed at shifting the blame onto others and deflecting attention from its complicity in this human tragedy and bear testimony to the fact that this government and its allies are using human rights as a tool to impose their biased political viewpoints on others. Can only express regret and deep concern over the large extent of these crimes and historic genocide while sympathizing with the Canadian Indigenous community, saying these crimes against humanity will never remain undisclosed to true justice seekers around the world, and the Canadian government should be held accountable for its dark past. An investigative team has found 66 more potential unmarked graves at a former residential school in British Columbia. The Williams Lake First Nation WLFN said at a press conference. The announcement of the discovery brings the number to 159 found at the former St. Joseph Mission Residential School. 93 were uncovered in May 2021.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
U.S. Four-star general is warning of a U.S. war with China by the year 2025. He has said the odds of this conflict with China, which would be over Taiwan, are very high. Why is the U.S. so hungry for war that it is even predicting wars before they happen instead of using diplomacy as one of its options? In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the coming U.S. war with China, which, if it does happen, may spell one of the biggest catastrophes that mankind has seen. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of the Spotlight. Jim Kavanaugh, political analyst and blogger, joins us from New York. Also joining us is Don DeBar, activist and commentator, who joins us from Austin, New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. I'd like to start out with you, Jim Cavanaugh, if I may, and ask you about this top Republican in the U.S., Congress. He has said that the odds of a conflict with China are very high over Taiwan to happen in 2 years' time. So my first question is, why is he, on behalf of the U.S., if I can say on behalf of the U.S., making predictions of a war instead of thinking, maybe we should try out diplomacy first before we predict of wars that we're going to get into?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. Secondly, please notice, everyone, that this is a Republican congressman who made this statement, and, of course, the general, Minahan, who made the statement that we'd probably be at war with China by 2025. So please notice that, you know, there's no political force in the American American political party. There's no anti-war political force. The Democrats want to blame Russia for all of their political failings, and the Republicans want to blame China for the fact that American capital was invested in China. So why is there no diplomacy? Because the United States is afraid of the rise of China as a strong economic and political power and military power. And the United States really can't abide by the fact that there was going to be, probably the Chinese are going to be the superior power in that part of the world, at least. And the United States just can't have that. And there's no negotiating it away, really. Now, you could have negotiations where you create a situation where everybody can live with the power of China and everybody can get along well and there's no wars that are necessary. But in fact, that's not what the United States wants. And what they're doing here is, I mean, what is the excuse for this? Taiwan is a part of China. That's American policy. There's one China. That was Taiwanese government policy. There's one China. So why does America have anything to do with trying to go to war over Taiwan? That's Chinese territory. This is really just a little crazy. They're going to Japan. They said they're going to help Japan become a more potent military power in the region. We heard this before with German tanks in Ukraine and Japanese attacking China. It's not a good song. We've heard it before, and I don't want to hear it again.
Okay, Don DeBar, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Great, because your picture was frozen there. Don DeBar, so let's get to the bigger question first, which I wanted to get to later, but since a guest there touched on it, Jim Cavanaugh, he has said, what place does the U.S. have to even be in that part of the world in terms of viewing itself and projecting its power, in this case in point, using Taiwan, saying that it might go to war with China over it? I mean, basically, to put it in a simpler terms, what right does the U.S. have to even project itself that way?
Well, it occupies Japan as 1945. It occupies much of the Japanese occupation in Korea. And it occupies the Philippines, which was the Spanish occupation since 1898. It has taken over the title to the right of occupation of parts of China, Vietnam, and others from France and whomever else. The U.S. is the global, imperial power, global colonial power, the successor to half a millennium of European colonialism, and it would be and almost was hegemon. The countervailing power in the world economically is China. India is also joining that, and basically an aggregation of the segments of Asian and Eurasian economy being assembled, for example, in the STO and other organizations, the military and other strategic partnership with Russia. These are all not just territories that the U.S. are not going to be able to incorporate any further into their global hegemon. And I'm saying U.S., we're really talking about the elite that has control the U.S. government and the European governments, et cetera. I'm in the U.S. This has nothing to do with me. I make no policy. The large bulk of the 330 million people that live here have zero input into policy. This is a small group of people that own most of what's here and a good part of what is around the world, and they intend to own the rest of it. They have control of the levers of government here, which means the U.S. military, that's had somewhere between half to $1 trillion a year that they've assembled the force every year for decades. And that's what pointed at China.
I'm sorry to jump in, Don DeBar. Your picture is frozen, unfortunately, so I'm going to have to move on, even though we did have your audio, but we got a bulk of what you said there. If you don't mind, let me move on to Jim Kavanaugh and go for the next question here. Even though Jim Kavanaugh, this general, has said what he has said does not represent the Pentagon, but it says that Michael McConnell, the new chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee in the U.S. House of Representatives, I mean, these are really, I don't know what type of adjective to use. Interesting statements is what I should can come up with. He says, I hope he's wrong, but I think he's right, though.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, if this is the type of mentality we're looking at when it comes to a war, gosh, I think we're in trouble. Now, let me move on to the whole issue of Taiwan. When we're looking at what the U.S. says, a possible attempt by China to exert control over Taiwan, okay, what are the chances of, first of all, or the odds of China making a move on Taiwan? And why do you think it hasn't made one already, if you think that it may?
Well, the chances get more likely every day that the United States makes these threats. The more the United States rhetorically and its political positioning makes threats which not only imply but kind of directly state that they're treating Taiwan as an independent country, that they're treating China as having no rights over Taiwan, and that they're going to build up Taiwan, and not only Taiwan, but other countries in the region like Japan, there's a history there again, into potent military powers against China, the more likely it is that China is going to say, we're not going to wait for them to build up Taiwan. China is not going to wait like Russia waited 8 years for the NATO to build up their forces in Ukraine. If China sees that happening, they're much more likely to say we're going to take control of Taiwan by force. So, you know, again, as you've implied, if there were a real effort at diplomacy, which was based on shared reasonable conditions, namely that the United States does not have the right to control the world, including the Pacific region, that China is a major power that deserves respect, and that Taiwan is a part of China, a lot of things that you could have a deal about that. We've had a deal for 50 years since Nixon. So why all of a sudden, because the United States feels it's under threat, it's declining in power, and it's going to try and stop it in some way. And that's why it doesn't want, it's making really threats against China, which it sees as a rising power. And it doesn't want to have a rising power that's going to displace it from ruling the world, including the Pacific Ocean, the Pacific region.
Don DeBar, the reason given over here by the general, he has said that both the U.S. and Taiwan are going to be holding presidential elections in the year 2024. And the way that it was reported, it says potentially creating an opportunity for China to take military action. Can you tell us how that creates an opportunity for China?
The United States wants to acquire Taiwan, in essence, as space outside of China, which would be a change in the status quo. The purpose of that is to, you know, counter the quote-unquote threat from China, which means, in essence, to try to stifle China as a potential rival around the world. Now, what we're seeing, the role that a rival to the United States plays, or to the, you know, the European imperial construct plays around the world, is that you can see in Africa, for example, where countries before had the opportunity to either be starved out of the global economy, sanctioned like Zimbabwe, et cetera, or to be exploited, where in essence people come in, take their stuff, and bring it back to the U.S. or Britain or wherever. And China comes in and offers another model. We'll help you develop your materials. We'll take some of what we need from you. We'll build roads, infrastructure. We'll partner. We want to help you make money so you can buy stuff from us, et cetera, et cetera. Alternative model. That is a threat to the foundation of the exploitative model that the U.S. has been following since it inherited from Britain and France and Spain, et cetera. There's, however, an opportunity here, because as the U.S. has been starving its own people now for a generation or two, and China's been accumulating a pile of cash, I see a possibility somewhere down the road where China not only goes, say, to Nicaragua or, you know, Venezuela and says, let's do business and bail you out of the problem with the U.S., but comes to some of the states like Texas and others and says, you know what, Washington's not giving you any money for development, for roads, or whatever. We have some. Why don't you look at those rights that the U.S. preaches everywhere else to secede? Consider seceding from the United States, and we'll write you a big check. There's a lot of possibilities for playing this game two ways as the United States decides not to pay attention to the international legal system and global order. And China is moving into a position where they can actually work some of that against the U.S. And that's going to be interesting if it doesn't result in the world getting blown up.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, so I'm really going to ask you to forgive me, but were you talking serious about the fact that China might come to the aid of one of the states, or are you just trying to drive
well,
a point there?
The Justice Department actually indicted some people over allegations that Russian agents were trying to encourage separatism in California, Texas, and elsewhere.
Sure, okay.
This was only in the past year, so
right.
There's no $500 changed hands there. Suppose China wrote a check for $5 billion to the Texas state government.
Sure, sure. I got you. Okay. So let's see here. We're taking a look at this general and its warning, whether it's from his boss who has a gut feeling it's going to happen or from him saying this off the whim, we don't know, but he has said it. Jim Kavanaugh, I'm curious as to whether this has anything to do with the most recent warning that the U.S. has leveled against China when it comes to crossing U.S.'s red line in terms of material and security assistance to Russia in the special military operation in Ukraine. This comes ahead of the U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken's visit to Beijing. Do you think this has anything to do with it when you have a general come out and make a statement like that? Are they connected?
Well, it may not be directly connected, but yes, they're connected. The United States does not want to see anybody supporting Russia in its actions in Ukraine. They want to drive a wedge between Russia and China. They're not doing it. They've driven them together. So they're making threats. I mean, it's a bluff. There's nothing they can do about it. The United States has no right to say we can pour advanced weapons into our side in Ukraine, but you can't give any help to the side that you favor in Ukraine. And I'll point out that the United States is doing and Israel are doing the same thing with Iran, and they're going to try and punish and destroy and attack military military production facilities in Iran because they're supplying material to the Russians in Ukraine.
I just want to make sure we're clear on that. Sorry, I had to say it. It's not Iran's official stance that is assisting Russia in a special military operation.
Right, right. Well, the United States believes it is. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
Is there any doubt that Russia has bought some equipment from Iran? I don't know. I mean,
before the special military operation. All right. Let me ask you this, Don DeBar. Ned Price says there's got to be a cost. The State Department spokesperson, because the U.S. thinks that there are companies that are providing assistance to Russia's special military operation in Ukraine. What kind of cost do you think that Price is talking about, aside from sanctions, I'm guessing? Any idea?
Well, it's impossible to imagine more sanctions since they've been piling them on since 1979, 1980. Well, we got a hint over the past couple days with the attack on Iran, a military facility. No one, at least as of the time that I last looked, has claimed responsibility for it, but there were certainly some strong suggestions from Ukraine and from Israel that they had a hand in this. And, of course, neither of those act without the United States' approval. And so you know, the situation in general, I reported on Friday in my newscast, starting with the 1997 speech that Biden gave when he was in the U.S. Senate, saying that Russia was going to have to do whatever the U.S. told it, because it, what was it going to do otherwise? Go to China? And he laughed and he said, and when he finds out that doesn't work, what's he going to do? Go to Iran? Well, we're now seeing those three cooperating in ways that are broader and deeper than anyone would have imagined. And it's during Biden's time in office as president. Mm-hmm. And so the U.S., of course, is not pleased with that. Each of these are, you know, the products of attempts by the U.S. to isolate them. They've tried to isolate so many countries in the world that it's now the U.S. that's being isolated, and everyone else is in the cool kids club that was kicked out of the global economy by the U.S. The balance of power is changing in favor of that configuration, and it's causing all kinds of, you know, upheaval in Washington. It's a dangerous time. And when they say that they that there's going to be a war in a year or two, people have to take that very seriously, and I'm certain that China does, and Russia, too.
Well, let's take a look at a notable event that took place, and I'd like to find out your reading into it, Jim Kavanaugh, where China turned down a U.S. offer for military deconfliction talks. Maybe you can tell us what that means, between U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and the Chinese Defense Minister earlier this month. Why is that even important? And that's how it was reported, but why is that important?
Well, sure. You know, I don't know what the devil's in the details with those things. At the same time that Lloyd Austin might be saying that to China, Joe Biden is going to Japan and saying, quote from the New York Times, we're going to build you into a potent military power again, you know, and there's a history to that that China knows very well. So, you know, and it's very clear from all of the political statements coming out of the Congress and coming out of the Pentagon and coming out of the mouth of the President of the United States and the visits that, you know, high-ranking Congress people have paid to Taiwan, that, you know, the United States, I don't know what the details of this deconfliction arrangement, deconfliction arrangement were, and that would be a nice thing to know, and that would be a nice thing to do. But you you can't talk deconfliction while you're arming Japan to go to war with China, and while you're arming Taiwan to be an American cat's paw in, as Don said, to be essentially acquired by the United States as an as Ukraine was, as a cat's paw against against China. So I'd have to look. I don't know what the details of what Austin was offering, what China was objecting to, and what the conditions of it are. But I think clearly we're seeing the United States really isn't accepting that Taiwan is part of China, that it's a one China, and the United States really isn't accepting the rise of China as a peer power that it has to deal with respect, and not just preaching and sanctions and building up military alliances to attack.
Well, the countries in that part of the world, Don DeBar, based on one of the polls that were taken, 7 out of 10 ASEAN members favor China over U.S. This was actually a survey. And also they feel these countries, the 73% of them, that it's becoming a staging ground between the U.S. and China, and they're not really into that, obviously. And they are worried as to where this is going to go. When we're looking at that type of favorability leaning towards China, what can the U.S. or what kind of reactions will the U.S. have? We know, obviously, the sale of arms would be one way to entice these countries, I guess, because if it comes down to trade, I think China's got the U.S. beat on that issue.
Well, when you speak about countries and polling data, you're talking about the people in the countries, and then the policy of the countries is what's determined by whatever the total output of the society is, generally in the hands of the government officials. It's interesting to look at the situation in Asia, where the policy is somewhat in alignment with the polling data, as opposed to the situation in Europe, where the polling data indicates one thing, that the people do not want to have World War III fought on their battleground, and the governments are moving forward full steam ahead with it. There's a huge vector there. Remember, these are the countries that have been lecturing the world, including Asia, for generations about democracy. You know, the United States, whoever's doing the planning here, and it's kind of frightening to imagine that this is actually what's being planned, but it is. When you have $1 trillion a year going into a, you know, a structure, and it's behaving, it's swinging around the world the way it is, it's clear that there is actually a brain somewhere that's formulating the actions, and that this is according to somebody's plan. The plan here seems to be to have a war simultaneously with Russia and China, using Europe on the one hand and Japan and I assume Korea, if they'll play along, and they may not, and Australia and others in Asia, to send them against Russia and China. And the assumption, I guess, at least in Langley, or at least a PR assumption in these countries, is that the war is going to be fought there and not here. Russia sending that boat over this way with those hypersonic missiles tells me that some of that war is going to take place in North America, and particularly around the areas like Washington and New York, where we are. And that makes me want to put some restraint. But, you know, our governments have nothing. They don't do anything that we tell them. And in Asia, apparently, the governments are at least listening to their people, or they agree with them.
Okay. Interesting that you talked about, I think it was you, Jim Kavanaugh, that you talked about how, or it was Don DeBar, I forget, how Ukraine, and it was Don, I think. You talked about Ukraine and then the U.S. and who else that was involved perhaps in this mini quadcopter game-like attack that took place, which we've shown videos of, which a couple of them were just blown up based on the defense system that there is there. And I'd like to throw at you, Jim Kavanaugh, if you're seeing that type of cooperation, what are the chances, if there is to be a military confrontation, for Russia to come into the picture to aid China, and at the same time, other countries like Iran? We know that a little over a year ago, China, Russia, and Iran held military exercises, naval exercises, I must say, in the Indian Ocean. Even though the sounds of all this is just so horrible, because we're just looking at war after war based on the scenarios that are being presented. But what do you think of that in terms of the cooperation of those countries with China against the U.S. and whoever else U.S. wants to bring in, like perhaps Japan, perhaps Korea? And let's not forget, North Korea is there also with their bombs.
Yeah, you know, that would be a very an important turn. I've always said, you know, in terms of the United States, driven by Israel's desire to attack Iran, you know, if Russia wants to be serious about that, they should have a defense of a treaty with Iran, which is a mutual defense treaty. We will come to each other's defense. China and Russia could be the same thing. We will come to each other's defense. I think these countries are, however, reluctant to do that. China and Russia are not going to, are not at the point, or Iran are not at the point where they're going to commit themselves in advance to fighting for each other. They're going to support each other in various ways, in material ways, I think, in this conflict with the missionary imperialism of the West and the military imperialism of the West when it comes to it. But that's, of course, the development of a real explicit alliance between these three countries.